Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. In recent weeks, this program has dedicated time to giving you the chance to speak directly with candidates in two important races, the 13th Congressional District race and the 52nd State Senate race. Today's guest is the Democratic incumbent in the 52nd District, Senator Mike Frerichs. Senator Frerichs was born and raised in Gifford, Illinois, just outside of Rantoul, and has represented the people of the 52nd District in the Illinois Senate since 2007. Before that, he was Champaign County Auditor. He's also a former member of the Champaign County Board, and while in the State Senate, Mr. Frerichs has chaired that legislative body's Agriculture and Conservation Committee. This fall, Senator Frerichs faces Republican challenger John Bambinick of Champaign, who appeared on this program last month. The two men seek to represent portions of Champaign and Vermilion counties, including the cities of Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and portions of Danville in the Illinois Senate. Mike Frerichs, welcome to Focus.
Craig, good to be back.
Well, I have much that I can ask Senator Frerichs. Ultimately, the purpose of this hour is to give you the chance to question him directly, and I hope you will do so by phone this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or via email to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we also welcome your questions on WILL's Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. And while we're getting some folks up on the line and ready to speak with you, maybe before we dive into various issues,
sure.
I thought maybe it might be helpful for our listeners to learn a little bit more about you outside of politics. What did you do prior to your life in public service?
Well, I've done a variety of things. In college, I majored in German studies. I spent my summers in Germany studying the East German school system and how it changed after unification. And then I went back into the summer to help restore a castle. So it seemed like the logical progression then for me to move to Taiwan to study Chinese. And I taught English.
Okay.
I taught to little kids, and I taught at the college level at the Taiwanese Air Force Academy. I came back to the States. I worked as a paralegal in a large law firm in Manhattan for a little while before decided it was time to come back home. When I came back home, I worked in my old alma mater, Rantoul Township High School, for a little while before working with a local investor, and we started up an engineering company monitoring bridges for structural integrity. After that, I got elected to the county board and became the Champaign County Auditor and was the auditor for 4 years before being elected to the Senate.
You grew up in Gifford. Just east of Rantoul, mm-hmm. Northeast of Champaign-Urbana. You now live in Champaign. Have you always had ties to this community pretty much your whole life?
Yeah, my family has been in this area for a while. On my dad's side, they go back about five generations. They've been farmers almost all of their life, but many of them were tenant farmers. And they didn't have enough land for my dad to go into farming, so he went to go work at a grain elevator, started driving a truck for that elevator, and then eventually became a full-time truck driver, a Teamster. My mom was a stay-at-home mom when we were growing up, but then went to work at the University of Illinois. She was a secretary here at the university. And so both sides of my family have been around here for a while. Although I left for several years, I always sort of knew that I think I wanted to come back to this area. And when I did come back and decided to really put down roots, went to look to buy a house and ended up buying my great-grandmother's old house in Gifford, Illinois, just a couple of blocks away from my parents. But about 5 years ago, my wife and I moved down here to town. She works at the university and just really cut down on our commuting time.
In general terms, how would you describe your political philosophy?
In general terms, I grew up in a working class, middle class family, and I think that government can't solve all of our problems, but the government can provide a hand up to people, and I think that's an acceptable role. We saw that in me. My family didn't have enough money for my college education, but the federal government stepped up and offered federally guaranteed student loans, offered Pell Grants that I qualified for. If you look back to my grandfather who grew up on that rural farm, his father died when he was in sixth grade and had to drop out of school. That was in the middle of the Depression. And FDR made sure that this country, took care of its least able and made sure that we brought electricity out in the area. And so government has a role where the free market fails to help step in and to provide opportunity for people of all walks of life.
So if that's government's role, what is your role specifically as a senator for the state of Illinois?
Well, there are a couple different ways to think about your role as a senator. One is that I'm a vessel for my constituents, that my job is to listen to them, find out how they want me to represent them in Springfield and vote their wishes. The other philosophy is I think I have the answers and I go out and tell people, trust me to go off and represent you. I think more often than not, I try and listen to my constituents. You know, there are some issues where just there are certain things I can't vote for you if I have a disagreement with my constituents. But by and large, it's to represent my people. And so the way I go about doing that is I try and be very public. I try and go out and knock on doors, attend public events, talk to my constituents, set up a system whereby we monitor people who call into my offices, and we send out surveys to see where people, which issues they support, and try my best to represent the will of the people of East Central Illinois.
Can you think of a couple of examples of times when your conscience required you in your mind to, this is the way I have to vote on this particular legislation, this particular issue, regardless of where my constituents may fall at this moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think just after the last election, there was a vote on repealing the death penalty in the state of Illinois. And I think the majority of my constituents probably supported the death penalty, but it's just something for me. I think that we can leave it up to other people to sort of judge later. I mean, I don't want to have blood on my hands. I think that we can incarcerate people. We can make sure the public is safe out there, but that I don't really want to have a death penalty that's irreversible. Because I think especially in light of the Northwestern students' investigation that found at least 12 people on death row who were wrongly there, I just don't think we as a society should be taking innocent life.
We have a number of folks waiting to chat with you, so let's go to those phone calls. We start with Casey in Champaign. Good morning.
Casey. Hi, am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, thanks for having me on. I guess Senator Frerichs, to us here in Central Illinois, it sounds like there's only a couple guys running the show down in Springfield. And, you know, my question for you is, vote for you or the other guy, you know, why should we care about these local races and, you know, races around the state? You know, people get a little frustrated, and I'd like to have your answer on that.
Okay. Well, that's not an unusual call as I go out and I talk with people. I've heard a lot of people have this feeling. You know, they read the newspaper and they see that Speaker Madigan, President Cullerton, Leader Cross, and Minority Leader Redonio, they're the people sitting down at the negotiating tables on these issues, and they say, well, why do we even bother sending you off there if they're the ones who are going to do that? I guess I would say I have a couple responses to that. Is one, just a simple necessity of negotiations. You can't have 177 people at a negotiating table and really expect to have produce a good product. You do need to delegate authority to certain people. But in my case, my leader is Senate President Cullerton. He knows before he goes into any of those negotiations what things I can support and what I cannot. So he knows when he's going to negotiate on a budget that if he expects to have my vote, we can't slash higher education funding or we can't slash K-12 funding. Those are big priorities for me. And so when he's trying to put together a majority of people who can support a budget, that, you know, he knows where I am. And so I feel like I'm represented in that room. But two, a lot of people have said, you know, hey, the leaders just call all the shots. You don't get to. I can tell you that when President Jones decided to step down, and there were several of us who got together and said, we want to see some changes. We want things run differently. Before, we had a rules committee in the Senate, and that rules committee was where bills went to die. If the Senate president didn't like a bill, it never got released. There was no public hearing. The public had no opportunity to participate or offer their thoughts on it. And one of the things we said of all the candidates for Senate president was we want to see some changes. And we put forward several changes, but one of them we says we don't want bills bottled up in rules. We want an opportunity to have our bills heard. And so it was a sort of symbolic thing, but they changed the name of the committee from the Rules Committee to the Committee on Assignments because we wanted to make sure that bills actually got assigned and they had a hearing. And that's been a big change, you know, with a few minor exceptions where some bills are duplicative. All bills have been assigned to committees. And once it gets assigned to a committee and there's a public hearing, the public has an opportunity to come in and to put forward witness slips and to offer testimony. And so I do think that sometimes it can seem like that the legislative leaders control the shots, but there have been changes, at least in the Senate, and I do think that if a senator is doing a good job, they reach out to their leader and they know what their priorities are going into these negotiations.
Let's take another call. We have Alex on the line from Urbana. Alex, good morning.
Hi. I had a question for Senator Frerichs about taxes. I work hard for my paycheck. I like to, you know, be able to keep that. There's a lot of stuff going on in the state that's just not working for me. I'm not seeing that. John Bamanek, he pledged that he's going to repeal the income tax increase on that very first day he's elected. So I guess my question for you is, will you make that same pledge?
Well, I guess I couldn't make the same pledge that would be repealed on the very first day, and I don't think that candidate Bambanek could make that either. He's one of 59 state senators. He himself can't repeal that on the first day. But I think, too, you need to look at what would that mean for this area. If it were to be repealed on his first day in office, you'd see about a $7 billion hole cast in the budget. And the big question is then, how do you cut your way out of that? And you have to have a balanced budget, and so you take $7 billion out, you have to take out $7 billion in spending. I haven't seen a proposal from my opponent yet to say how he would fill that hole. I think what I heard was, well, I'll sponsor bills to cut that. But I think the public really deserves to know up front what you would cut. You know, the only group out there that's put forward a legitimate proposal for cutting $7 billion out of this budget has been the Illinois Policy Institute. And I think the caller was referencing Mr. Bambanek. I think he's shown support of the Illinois Policy Institute in the past. The way they do that is they push all responsibilities downhill. They push them down on local government. So they say, well, we can survive with $7 billion less because we just will keep all of the state income tax. Currently, today, the state shares 10% of the revenue from income tax with municipalities and county government. And they say, we're just not going to share that anymore. Well, what does that mean when the city of Champaign, the city of Urbana, or Champaign County no longer receive that money? It means they're going to have to cut things like police and fire, or they're going to have to raise property taxes and sales taxes. And that's not something I support. Another proposal was the state makes a large contribution to the teachers' retirement system. And the Illinois Policy Institute said, we're not going to make that anymore. They're going to do that cost shift onto local school districts. And that means either your local schools will receive, have less money to spend on teachers, or you're going to have an increase in property taxes. And so I think it's very easy to run around and saying, I'll lower your taxes. But really what I think we're going to see is anyone who says they're going to reduce the state income tax is you're going to see increases in your property taxes. And my opponent in the past has argued in favor of some property tax increases. I just think that's a regressive tax. I don't think it's the right way for the state to go. So, no, I wouldn't make the same pledge my opponent did because I don't think it'd be good for this area. And the other thing you would definitely see is if you put a $7 billion hole in our state budget, you would see massive cuts to higher education. You'd probably look at something like a $300 to $400 million decrease in funding for the University of Illinois. The university could definitely function, with taking $350 million out of their budget, but they would have to lay off people. And I just ask, what would that do for our local economy if you put that kind of hole in the university's budget, and they then turned around and laid off 500 people from the university? What does that do to our housing market? I think my guess is it probably has a lot of vacant houses. What does it do for our auto dealers, for our restaurants? I think there's going to be a lot of disposable income, and I think it would have very negative consequences for this part of the state. Now, in some northern suburbs that don't have as much state government, like I think where Mr. Bambanek grew up, that might be a good thing for them. They wouldn't notice as much. But here in East Central Illinois, we have a prison over in Danville. You have lots of state agencies around here, and you have the University of Illinois. I just think that's a reckless approach for our area.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. We'll go next to Steve in Urbana. Steve, good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call, and thanks, Senator Frerichs, for all that you do for the people of your constituency. I have two questions. First of all, I'd like to know what you're specifically doing to implement the recommendations of the Illinois Reform Commission, which would save the state billions of dollars annually and certainly help it in its economic predicament. And also, those recommendations would markedly help to clean up Illinois government and make it more efficient and effective. And my second question is...
Okay, could I ask you, are there specific recommendations from the Illinois Reform Commission that you would like me to speak upon? Because
all
I think that
them.
The Reform Commission put out their report a couple of years ago after, Governor Quinn called after Blagojevich left, and I'm not sure which ones haven't been implemented, which ones have, if you have specific recommendations for me to comment on.
I think the only ones that have been implemented have to do with fundraising and all the others that have to do with, for example, procurement. Every aspect of Illinois government was discussed and specific recommendations were made, which would make Illinois government more efficient and effective. And essentially, that has been just put on not a back burner, but just absolutely ignored in the state, except for one or two minor recommendations. So if you're not familiar with that, I would like you to go back and actually review those recommendations, because they're a blueprint for making Illinois government more efficient, effective, and less corrupt.
Okay. Well, and I think it's something we need to be working on, but I would be interested in which one specifically, because there were recommendations for procurement reform that you saw really had negative consequences to a place like the University of Illinois.
Procurement procedures in the state would save the state, according to the Collins report, billions of dollars.
Okay. Well, I agree the state needs to do things to save money and efficiency, but sometimes these organizations or these task forces can say they're going to save billions of dollars, but if you look at something like procurement reform, the recommendations that came out and that were implemented had really negative consequences for the state of Illinois and for institutions like the University of Illinois, because in an attempt to take politics out, we created a lot of hoops that people had to jump through. And I just heard from numerous professors who received federal grants that they had problems fulfilling the terms of these grants, or they had vendors out there that for specific technical piece of equipment said, we don't want to deal with the state of Illinois. We don't want to sell to you because you put too much of a burden on us. And for something like the state buying paper, the state buying pencils that are basically commodities, yes, we should put these things out for bid. We should make sure we get the lowest cost. But for some professor using electronic microscope that he applies for a grant using a specific type of microscope, for him to have to go out and get multiple bids and for them to submit background checks and things like that, we found there were real problems with those recommendations. And so I worked very closely with the university to roll back, but to reform them in a way that made sense, that didn't just come in and paint with a broad brush, because there are certain units of state government that just have very different purchasing requirements than, say, the College of Engineering or Electrical Computer Science here on campus.
That's correct, and they did make recommendations that would extend across the state to make it more efficient and effective. Maybe that's worth reviewing again. My second question is, if the state is having so much difficulty in paying its bills and meeting its obligations especially retirees and considering invalidating their constitution, how can we afford $18 to $20 billion in capital projects and at the same time cut out a K-12 education program of $15 million for the National Board certified teachers, which is a totally proven effective way of increasing the effectiveness of education throughout the state? And so that cut in education, okay, with continuing to spend billions and billions of dollars on capital projects seems totally inconsistent with at least what you state are your priorities.
Okay. Well, so in 2009, we found ourselves in the greatest recession of my lifetime, the greatest recession since the Great Depression of the late 1920s and 30s. And one of the things that we decided we need to do is we need to put people to work. And there are different ways of doing that. You can spend it more on your operating expenses, or you can spend on infrastructure improvements. And there were the only real support we had out there was on things, spending on infrastructure. So spending on your roads, your bridges, your schools, your university buildings. If you look here on campus, that capital bill provide money for the renovation of Lincoln Hall, for Blue Waters, for new buildings going up right now, EC&E. And I think that was money well spent. You have investments that are going to continue to serve the people of the state of Illinois for many years to come. Now, that money sometimes confuses people. They say, well, if you've got money for Lincoln Hall, why don't you have money for teachers' pensions? Why don't you have money for school programs? They are separate pots of money. And so that capital bill is funded. The state basically issued bonds, and those bonds will be paid back over a certain number of years from certain dedicated revenue sources. So there was an increase in license plate fees. There was supposed to be money from video gambling expansion, for some other things like that. So when that bill was passed, that money could only be used to retire those bonds, and those bonds can only be the proceeds can only be spent on capital projects, things that have a long expected life of something like 20 years. They can't be spent on operating costs. And so I completely understand why a lot of people just see dollars being spent in one place and say, why can't they be transferred here? But legally, they can't be transferred. And so some people say, well, then you should have just raised those revenues and spent them on things like K through 12 education. Well, there weren't enough votes to do that. I mean, you needed a supermajority of votes. And the Republicans said, you know, we're willing to agree to some of these fee increases and taxes if they go spend on infrastructure in our state, and especially in their districts. They fought very hard for that. And they weren't willing to put votes on other votes. And so, like I said, I understand why it's frustrating, and it may not reflect all priorities, but politics is sometimes the art of compromise and what is trying to find out what is possible and what we can get done. And that's what we were able to get done. And I also won't apologize, because at a time when a lot of people were out of work, you know, those infrastructure projects put people to work here in this community. Here and over in Danville, we got money for the community college over there. They have an expansion that's going to be able to bring a lot more students through for training in nursing, you know, something we've had a critical shortage in, not just in East Central Illinois, but in the state of Illinois. And so we're going to continue to receive benefits from that spending for years to come, not just in the construction, but the training that's going to go through there. And you see it in road projects around here that help us remain competitive for companies that have to get their products to market. And so I think that was a good use of money, and people can argue about other good use of that money, but just understand there are restrictions on where the money can be spent.
Getting back to the caller's questions in terms of reform, a couple of minutes ago you mentioned supermajority vote. We see this at the national level. We see this at the state level. Should there be supermajority votes in the legislature, or should it be simple majority for anything?
Yeah, I think democracy majority rules, and the vast majority of our votes require a simple majority. Now, there are certain things like bonding that require a supermajority. We could argue about that. Overriding a governor's veto requires a supermajority. That one seems to make sense to me, because if you require just a simple majority, then the governor's veto wouldn't mean very much. Every bill that gets to his desk has a simple majority. If he vetoes it and sends it back, and all you need was a simple majority, there'd be no real reason for the governor to veto it. Clearly, could override him. But yes, so this is also a question I think voters are going to have a choice on this fall when they go into the ballot box. There's a constitutional amendment question which would require a supermajority for pension benefits to be increased in the state of Illinois. And you can argue on the merits of that. I would say that I think majority of the legislators have realized we have problems funding our pensions today, and I think it's unlikely you're going to see a lot of pension benefit sweeteners introduced. And if they are, I think there are a lot of people who say, hey, we can't afford this right now at a time when many people are talking about reducing pension benefits. So there's one they want to bring a supermajority. I think it's sort of a slippery slope that at some point, if you say, well, that these sort of enhancements need a supermajority, and well, I think California had passed a bill that said there any tax increase needed a supermajority. And pretty soon what you find yourself with is gridlock. And the public expects the ruling party to be able to get something done. You see the U.S. Senate. They say, well, the Democrats run the Senate. Why don't they pass this bill out? Well, because of they need 60 votes in order to stop a filibuster, that any threat of a filibuster basically can stop legislation from going forward. And I think there was a reason for the Senate having that there in the past. But today, it really just sort of leads to a lot of gridlock. And that's the big frustration I think a lot of people express to me. You know, it's not so much one party wants something different than I want, and I'm mad about that. But it's just, they just want to see government work, and they want to see people work together. And that's been a problem, I think, at the state level, but much more so at the federal level.
Another reform concept that gets tossed around a lot is term limits. Mm-hmm. Do you favor term limits in the Illinois Senate?
Well, I think that the founders of our country put in place a mechanism for term limits, and that's elections. You know, we don't elect people for life, we don't elect people for life, that the voters have an opportunity when they have a problem with their elected official to remove them in the next election. And, you know, the problem I've seen in other states that have enacted term limits of anywhere from 6 to 8 years is it does take a little while for someone to become familiar with the body, to learn their way around. And that can take anywhere from 4 to 8 years, in some cases, to really become comfortable. And just about that time, they're finally learning how to be effective and learning different parts of state government. They're out. They're kicked out. And then you're replaced with new people. And sometimes fresh blood can be valuable to an organization like the legislature, but sometimes that institutional experience can be valuable as well. And I think a good cross range is important. And if a legislator is in too long and they forget what's really important, if they're not representing their constituents, then that next election, they can be removed. And I think that as much as people get frustrated, and they do get frustrated with what appear to be career politicians there and say they're not listening, they're not responsive, I just ask them, if you kicked them all out, then who really has the power in the legislature? And it wouldn't be the legislators as much as it would be staff or bureaucrats and lobbyists. And there's no term limits on lobbyists. There's no term limits on staff. And they'd be the ones with institutional knowledge. And as much as people think that they're legislators, you know, they're there too long and they're unaccountable, I can tell you that government bureaucrats and lobbyists are even less accountable to the public than elected officials.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and as part of our effort to better inform you in advance of the November election, we are offering you a chance to speak directly with candidates in a couple of key offices here in Central Illinois. In recent weeks, we've spoken with candidates in both the 13th Congressional District race and the 52nd State Senate District race, and we continue today with the Democrats seeking another term representing the 52nd District in the Illinois Senate. That's Mike Frericks. 52nd District includes portions of Champaign and Vermilion counties, including the cities of Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and portions of Danville. We welcome your phone calls this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have Kelly, Joe, and Kevin waiting on the line. We'll get to you in just a minute, but we are due for a short break. This is Focus.
After months of heated campaigning, President Barack Obama and Republican nominee Mitt Romney will meet for their first debate in the battleground state of Colorado. The topics? Domestic issues. The economy, health care, the role of government, and how they would govern as president over the next 4 years. I'm Guy Raz. On Wednesday, join us for special coverage of the first presidential debate from NPR News.
Coverage starts at 8 p.m. here on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible in part by Sinfonia de Camera, presenting Lilacs in Bloom on Saturday, October 6th at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert. George Walker joins Sinfonia for a premiere of his work for cello and orchestra and a performance of his Lilacs. Ticket information is available at 333-6280.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're offering you a chance to speak directly with another candidate running for a key office representing citizens of East Central Illinois. Today we're talking with State Senator Mike Frericks. He is the incumbent in the Illinois 52nd State Senate District, and he's running against Republican John Bambanek for that seat, which comprises portions of Champaign and Vermilion counties, including the cities of Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and portions of Danville. To join the conversation, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email your questions for Senator Frericks to will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go next to Kelly in Tolono. Good morning, Kelly.
Hi. Good morning, Senator Frericks.
Good morning.
Every politician wants to talk about their greatest accomplishments and all the work that they've done for citizens of Illinois. I would like you to talk about your biggest disappointment serving in the state Senate.
Biggest disappointment. I'd say my most disappointing bill, I think, was when I sponsored a constitutional amendment to allow the voters to vote on whether we can have progressive tax rates in the state of Illinois. You know, I don't know if you'll know this, but that state constitution prohibits us from voting, from enacting progressive or graduated income or rates on state income tax. I thought that's something that was probably a problem with our state constitution, something I wanted to change, or at least have the public to have some say in this. And so very early in my tenure, I filed a bill for a constitutional amendment. I was told that, well, no, we didn't want to vote on that. We kept with it, and eventually we got called for a vote in the Senate. And something that I thought was a no-brainer, and I thought it was a no-brainer because just a couple days before, the Republicans had been pushing for a constitutional amendment on the power of recall. And Governor Blagojevich was very much opposed to that, and it was clear that President Jones didn't want it to go. Republican after Republican stood up and said, let the people have a voice. Let the people choose. You don't trust the public you know, that's wrong. They ought to have an opportunity to vote on this. And it was defeated. So 2 days later, I introduced my bill, and I got up and I said, there are a lot of people in this room, some of which may not agree with the purpose of this bill, but you all stood up 2 days ago and said the public ought to have a voice. And then to a person, all those people who stood up saying the public ought to have a say on recall said the public shouldn't have a say on graduated income tax rates. It was a disappointing day for me. It was frustrating because of the sort of blatant hypocrisy. That, you know, in politics, we all expect a degree of hypocrisy, but it was just out there. And it was disappointing because I stood up and I think I took questions against that bill for probably about an hour as Republican after Republican got up and talked about how terrible this would be for the people of the state of Illinois. I mean, Senator Bill Brady got up and said that if we enact this, we could see a 50% tax rate on businesses driving business out of the state of Illinois. I thought he was joking. I said, you know, the only way you could have that happen is if we passed out of the chamber with a supermajority. And then it passed out of the House with a supermajority. And then 60% of the people of the state of Illinois voted on it affirmatively. And then it changed the Constitution. And then if we came back, and because our Constitution also has a restriction on the disparity between the rates of corporate income tax and personal income tax, so in order we would have to increase our personal income tax rate to something like 30%. I said, there's no way that's going to happen, but yes, I guess technically you could see that. And with a straight face, he said, well, then that's why I'm encouraging everyone to vote no on this, because we could see a 50% tax rate on businesses and businesses fleeing the state of Illinois. Yeah. It was really disingenuous, and it was a disappointing day. It wasn't able to pass. I mean, this is something that's not a radical idea. We've had progressive income tax rates at the federal level for 100 years. And in that 100 years we've had progressive income tax rates, we've seen some of the greatest expansion of our economy in the world. You just see phenomenal expansion of our economy throughout the 50s and 60s while we had progressive tax rates. So one of my disappointments not getting that passed, but I guess if you have some time, I'll say the other real sort of disappointment I've had is when I ran in 2006, I promised to work on a tax swap. Sort of change the way we fund education in the state of Illinois and not be so reliant on the income tax, our property tax, be more reliant on income tax, and we could spread our resources more equitably around the state. Because I think one of the biggest problems we have in the state of Illinois, one of the greatest inequalities we have is in different school districts. You have some school districts in the state of Illinois that do phenomenally well, that will spend $20,000 a year per student or more, and some in other parts of the state and downstate that spend closer to $5,000 or $6,000 a year per student. And although money itself doesn't make the difference in quality of education, money sure helps. It helps you reduce class sizes. It helps provide technology that's going to be valuable to you. It helps attract better quality teachers. And I just think that it is a moral problem that we allow children who have no say over where they're born, the access to education is dependent on the street that they're born on. And that's just sort of wrong. I'd like to make that change. Unfortunately, in 2008, we're hit by this Great Recession. That dramatically decreases the amount of money coming into the state because there are a lot of more people qualifying for Medicaid. It increases the amount of money we're spending on Medicaid, created big deficits. And a lot of the momentum we had early on for that changing how Illinois education is funded really sort of evaporated as we began trying to just bail ourselves out from the effects of this recession.
You were talking a minute ago about taxes, and that's a subject on the mind of Joe in Urbana. Joe, welcome to the show.
Yes, gentlemen. Speaking of hypocrisy and jobs, Senator Frerichs, it was your one vote that got us the 67% tax hike that cost us as many as 30,000 jobs a month, August 2011. And Jimmy Johns is moving out of Champaign-Urbana, taking millions of dollars with it. You also indicated that all of that money for that 67% tax hike was going to go to pay down the deficit, which not one dime has gone to that. And now you want another several billion-dollar tax hike. Explain to us why we should believe that any of that money is going to go for what you said it would.
Okay. Well, I think I recognize some talking points from the other side.
No, there's no talking points. It's a question.
Okay. Well, what I'll tell you is, as I discussed earlier, what is the alternative? If you were to cut that out, I mean, you said that I was the vote on this. There were 30 votes in the Senate. There were 61 votes in the House. I wasn't the only vote on this, but I defend my vote on it. I defend because what was the alternative? We were looking at large deficits for the state of Illinois that require massive cuts in spending. Now, we didn't raise enough revenue to take care of all our issues. You've seen cuts in state government. I mean, just talk to anyone who's a school district, a university, a provider of people with developmental disabilities in this area, and they'll tell you cuts have come. But what I didn't want to see was the type of cuts that, you know, some opponents of this wanted to see. I mean, Senator Brady campaigned saying we'd have a 10% across the board cut in spending, and that would solve our problem. That wouldn't have begun to solve the deficit in the state of Illinois. He was just being dishonest to people when he said 10%. It would not have done it. It would have required things much greater. And there are expenses we have on our debt payments that we can't just cut. We have to pay them. The federal government has Medicaid in place, and there are certain minimum requirements the state has to provide. You can't just say, I'm going to cut 50% of Medicaid. We're obligated to make certain payments as long as people qualify for those standards. Now, we did make significant cuts in Medicaid this year, but there's only so far we can go. And so those cuts would have fallen dramatically. I mean, you're talking probably 40% cut in state funding to the University of Illinois. That would have dramatic impact on this area. And not just for those people who are employed at the University of Illinois, but those businesses in our community that sell products to them, whether it be an auto dealer or a restaurant owner, that would be a big problem. Now, and you mentioned Jimmy John's. I went and I spoke with Jimmy, sat down, talked to him for a while. He definitely has some concerns about this, and I had offered to work with him. I don't think he has said that he is leaving the state of Illinois, at least I hope not, because he told me before he packed up and moved, he'd come back and talk to me, and I take him as a man at his word. You said that I said that all of that money would go down to pay down our deficit. Well, there was a deficit in the difference between projected revenues and expenses, and then there was a backlog of bills. And that bill we voted for, the bill I voted for, had set money aside to pay down bonds that would have paid off our bills to the state. Unfortunately, that bonding requires a supermajority, as we discussed earlier, and that supermajority was not there. The Republicans said, we're not voting for it. And so we have started to pay down, but it has been a very slow process. So I think we already owe money to our school districts, our universities, our vendors, our service providers in the state of Illinois. They're being forced to go out and either spend down their reserves or go out and get loans. You know, they didn't get into this business to be bankers and to be lending money to the state of Illinois. There are people out there that would lend money to the state of Illinois. And I'd rather pay our lenders than to borrow from our vendors out there. So that's a change that if you want to convince people on the other side of the aisle that we're serious about paying down our backlog of bills, there's a mechanism in place to do that. We just don't have enough support to do that at this time. And you mentioned another tax hike proposed. I'm not sure what you're talking about. I haven't proposed another tax hike. When I voted for that, I said, this is the plan. We're going to have to balance our budget through a series of cuts and controlling and spending, finding more efficiencies, and with new revenue. And so I don't know where the point about another tax hike comes from.
Just to clarify in regards to Jimmy John Leotode, on September 18th, he was in a panel discussion in Chicago hosted by the Bush Institute, where he suggested his licensing division could be moved to Florida as soon as next year, with other parts of the business going to Texas or Indiana in 2 to 4 years. But he has made such a threat before.
Oh, no, I know that he's made threats, but I also know that he's been contacted by various media, and I don't think we've heard a follow-up from that. And I've am trying to work with him on this issue.
Let's go next to Kevin in Champaign. Kevin, good morning.
Good morning, Senator. I guess one of my biggest frustrations is during campaign season, we hear a lot of our elected officials and candidates talk about the need for more bipartisanship in order to get things done. But then once session comes back in, it really seems to be kind of lacking. So I was wondering if you could talk about some of your colleagues across the aisle that you either have worked with or would be interested in working with, and where you think we can maybe find some middle ground to get some more things done.
Well, I agree with you. As I said earlier, one of the biggest complaints I hear from people is just sort of the gridlock. And they say, you know, neither party is interested in getting anything done. They're just interested in scoring political points, and there's an awful lot of posturing. I'd say that here in East Central Illinois, I've tried very hard to work across the aisle. So when I came in, even though Representative Bill Black had supported my opponent in the election, you know, right after the election was over, he came and said, I'd like to work with you. We've got problems here in Vermilion County in East Central Illinois that are too big to tackle by ourselves that need solutions. And so I worked very well with Representative Black for the first 4 years I was in office. He was a great mentor to me because I told people, being in the majority, I had basically a key to open up a lot of doors. But Bill, who had been there for a long time, knew what was behind those doors and was really helped me be more effective. And on various things, we worked together. I thought it was a good role model. His successor, Representative Hayes, and I have worked together very well together as well. And, you know, it's one of the things I think both of us hear a lot over in Vermilion County, we're out, is they say it's nice to see a Democrat and Republican working together and actually saying nice things about each other. We don't agree on every issue, but we agree when there's something affecting East Central Illinois that it's our job to work together to get that done. Now, the other thing I'll tell people who feel like there's been no progress, that there's just gridlock in Springfield, is you can look at the House. You know, for the last 2 years, after some acrimonious times, the Democrats and Republicans, Speaker Madigan and Leader Cross, have come together, and they've agreed that they're going to work on the budget in a bipartisan fashion. And that starts with coming to an agreement on how much money is going to come into the state. Now, that seems like a natural thing to do, but in the past, sometimes we've started with how much money do we want to spend and how do we get there? They started with how much money do we expect to come in, and then backing into that's how much money we have to spend on programs. And then they've let really go to their committees, which are bipartisan, to work out some of those details. And we can disagree on some of the priorities they chose, but at least they were done in conjunction working together. And in those committees, they've been bipartisan for the last 2 years. So I have great hope that we can continue to have some bipartisanship there. Unfortunately, on the Senate side, we haven't seen quite the same amount of cooperation. We've heard people saying, you know, we need to cut taxes, but there are no actual solutions proposed for how they're going to go about in doing that. They've said we need to have a balanced budget and we need to roll back this tax increase. But for the last 2 years, despite numerous pleas, they've never put forward an actual proposal for how they do that. And I think the reason they haven't done it is because they know, like the Illinois Policy Institute, the only way you do it is by cutting massively our aid to units of local government, which are going to result in property taxes. And that's not popular and it's not responsible.
We have about 7 or 8 minutes left. We have a couple of calls and a few emails. I want to see if we can maybe get through all of them, and I'll ask our callers.
I'll try and answer faster.
Yeah. Thanks very much. Let's go next to David in Urbana. David.
Yes, please. Thank you. First, I have a question, but I also want to comment on an earlier reply you made about educational expenditures. I think you'll find if you check, the high end of cost per student or expenditure per student in the northwest suburbs is above $30,000 per student now.
Okay, that may be I might have understated. Yes, there is a big, but we can agree there's a big disparity in throughout the state of Illinois.
The other thing on that subject, and I'll be quick, is the University of Columbia did a study which is very nearly definitive, and they found the highest correlation between any factors affecting education and educational outcomes was the money spent per student. I just thought I would point to that. My question is, what is your stand on reducing pensions to university employees and other state employees?
Okay. Well, I'll try and answer this quickly, although this is a big one and important to a lot of people around here, is the state constitution is fairly clear that you shall not diminish benefits for retirees or public employees. So I think we cannot do that unless you have some sort of negotiated agreement. You know, you could have public employees say, hey, we didn't cause this problem. It wasn't our underfunding. We paid into the system. It was the state's underfunding that caused this problem. But we do acknowledge there is a problem. There's a large unfunded liability out there. And in order to ensure that we're able to receive our benefits, you know, because the Constitution can protect them, but if there's no money in there, it's difficult to pay them out. We're open to some sort of reforms. Well, you saw some of the unions propose perhaps current employees could pay a slightly larger percentage of their salary. They could agree to maybe some reductions. But I think the only way it stands up to the Constitution is if this is bargained and negotiated like we do on salaries. So I think the Constitution protects them, but I think everyone, and I've had lots of my constituents come and say, I'd be willing to pay a little more. I'm willing to be part of the solution. I'm just not willing to be the entire solution. And that seemed to be how several people in Springfield are approaching this, is just saying, well, there's unfunded liability. Let's take it out of their benefits. Let's increase their contributions instead of realizing we all have some sort of stake in honoring our promises and commitments.
Earlier this year, you voted against a proposed constitutional amendment to require a 3/5 majority vote of state lawmakers to increase employee pensions. You were one of just two lawmakers to do so. Why?
Well, that's that bill, if you read it, it is a much longer, complicated bill than what you just said. And if that was all it wanted to do, I think I still would have some problems with the slippery slope of making everything a supermajority. But there's some other people out there who have read through this who say that this opens up in a backdoor way to reducing benefits for public employees. And I think that's a little disingenuous the way it's worded.
Paul is in Champaign County. Paul, go ahead.
Well, actually, Amendment 49 seems to put some of that into place, and there's not a lot of talk about it. It smacks me that it's related to ALEC. And how did that actually get onto this is Constitutional Amendment 49.
Yeah, the one we were just discussing.
You didn't actually say it does introduce a supermajority, which I think is a goal of this ALEC outfit, and it's sort of a slippery slope, it seems to me. But on the face of it, it doesn't really affect anything but increases. But then, anyway, since that's been treated, one thing that bipartisanly wasn't done was restructuring the debt. And there's a lot of to and froing about how we're still paying this exorbitant interest rate, and people, suppliers are still not getting. So why don't you just treat that for a moment? Appreciate it.
Sure, and I wish there'd be more bipartisan support on this. It seems like the fiscally conservative thing to do. So people on the Republican side of the aisle have said, we can't have any more debt, no new debt. And I agree with them, but we've already obligated ourselves for that debt. That we already have debt out there. What we're looking to do is to restructure it. And when you explain it to people, you know, if you have a mortgage on your home and you're paying 8% interest and you can refinance for 4% interest, who wouldn't want to do that? Yes, you are taking on a new mortgage, but that new mortgage pays down the old mortgage. And this bonding would pay down our old debts, you know, our debts that we owe to vendors, and then we would owe it to lenders at a lower rate. It seems to be the right thing to do, but I think there's some people who have been caught up in the talking points that no new borrowing, we can't support any borrowing. Sometimes borrowing to pay down older, higher interest rate debt is the smart, fiscally conservative thing to do.
We have this email from Dean who asks, you sponsored legislation last session promoting green energy special areas. Is there a future for another attempt for something similar next session? Also, if you could describe the potential economic impact in the 52nd if legislation such as this would be passed.
Yeah, I really wish this could have passed. You saw other states had similar legislation. California, I think Colorado had done something like this. In light of this, I think it was HUD had issued a ruling that basically made this very difficult to happen. And so I'm still working with our legal staff to redraft this legislation in a way that's compliant with HUD. What I think it would do is it would prompt an awful lot of energy improvements to homes. You know, there are people out there that say, hey, I'd like to do some things to weatherize my home or put in a geothermal system or put in some solar panels in my house, but it's an expensive capital outlay and I don't have the money today. If you go to a bank, it might be difficult to get that kind of money lent to you. And what this would have done was allow them to pay for that over time, you know, through their property taxes at a low interest rate. I think it was the right thing to do, would have employed people and ultimately reduced our energy dependence. But we need to work with the federal government's rulings to retool this, and it's something I'm looking to work on in the future.
Another email question asking, please talk about how large companies can make arrangements with the state to collect state taxes from workers, but do not turn it over to the state as an incentive to locate in a state, therefore increasing the tax burden on small business owners. Does this happen in Illinois?
I'm not sure specifically about this, but I was probably referring to is there was a big deal last year or so. A large employer like Sears had negotiated some tax breaks, and a lot of people said, well, you know, why can a big company get a tax break, but then smaller companies don't? And I think that's the wrong thing to do. But that bill had lots of provisions in it. I was not supportive the first time it was called for vote because of those incentives to large employers, but eventually it was reworked. There was money put in for a large priority of the Farm Bureau, and being chairman of the Agriculture Committee and having a lot of agricultural area. It's one of those that eventually you realize politics is the art of compromise. It doesn't always produce something that fits what you want 100%, but you end up supporting something that gets you some of what you want.
And we have this question from Roland asking, do you feel your district gets our fair share of IDOT road funds? I am informed that IDOT District 5 is the lowest funded district in the state. What can be done to change this?
Well, this has been a problem, something I've worked on with IDOT. You know, they come back and say, well, you don't have as many miles of road. You're not quite as populous. They make excuses for this, but it seems fairly clear that East Central Illinois has been neglected for the last several years in this area. You see it in the quality of our roads. Every district complains they're not getting enough. Every legislator should be fighting for more. But I do think we have a legitimate beef here in District 5.
Senator Mike Frericks represents the 52nd district in the Illinois Senate. He is seeking another term in office and faces John Bambanek, the Republican nominee in next month's election. Senator Frericks, thanks for joining us today.
Craig, I'm happy to be here today.
As I've mentioned through the hour, we have sought to bring all of the candidates from both the 52nd state Senate race and the 13th congressional district race onto Focus before Election Day. We now have had all but one on the program. We are still trying to secure a date for that last candidate. That's Republican Rodney Davis, who is running in the 13th congressional district race sometime in the coming weeks. As you might imagine, campaign schedules are often hectic, but also somewhat fluid. So we do remain optimistic that we'll be able to have Mr. Davis on soon, and we're continuing to work with his campaign to try to make that happen. So we'll keep you posted. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. And remember that you can hear this program twice each day on WILL AM 580. It airs live at 10 a.m., then is rebroadcast each weeknight at 8 p.m., although I should point out we will be preempted this Wednesday night by the first of the presidential debates. On tomorrow's show, a conversation with Kevin Delaney. He's a professor of sociology at Temple University, and his new book is entitled Money at Work. In it, he explores how what we do for a living and the people we work with can have a significant impact on how we think about money. That's on tomorrow's show. Today's show was produced by Travis Stancil. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.